All right, everybody. Hello and welcome back to In Liberty and Health. And today's conversation, I'm sure, is going to be very, very fruitful. And it's something that I've talked about quite a bit recently. And that's kind of the attack on free speech that we're seeing under the Trump administration, which is very concerning. And there seems to be a lack of pushback on it, which to me was honestly kind of surprising. But before we get into all that stuff, if you are a channel member right now, I have the GoPro footage last night from a Common Crowns performance at the Castle Pub being mixed. It looks good. It sounds good. I'm a retard, and I got way too drunk Friday night to figure out how to start a GoPro and not do a weird time-lapse thing. So I can rebuild a Cadillac engine, but apparently I can't figure out how to start a GoPro correctly once you get a few drinks in me, but that's neither here nor there. So please consider becoming a channel member for $2.99 a month. Would greatly support or greatly help me out. And then you get all the footage of a Common Crown that I can possibly figure out how to get, as well as some podcasts that don't have any commercials or anything like that in them. So of course, all the links below for my guests, everything she's got going on, everything I've got going on, Tiger Fitness through the link below. Use code Kyle at checkout to let them know I sent you. And with all that stuff out of the way, let's get into today's show.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
And welcome to the show, Miss Janine Yunez. How are you doing?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm fantastic. I came across your Twitter after I think I seen you on with what the hell is it? System Update with Michael Tracy and Glenn Greenwald on a panel that you did once. And then you kept coming across my Twitter after the whole Mahmoud Khalil situation kind of came up. And I found your takes on it to be very, very enlightening. So why don't you let my audience know who you are and what you do?
Sure. So I'm a civil liberties attorney in Washington, D.C. I sort of started doing this work actually under the Biden administration. I was very opposed to COVID restrictions. And so I brought a lot of litigation challenging them and sort of segued into free speech issues because the Biden administration was involved in sort of coercing social media companies to censor certain kinds of speech, especially that questioning the COVID vaccines and the 2020 election. And I argued that was a First Amendment violation. And that case eventually reached the Supreme Court last year. So I took a little bit of a turn after, it's kind of after October 7th. There's some overlap, I guess. There's been a lot of censorship going on under the Trump administration now. I mean, it was sort of, there was still some going on under Biden, but it was much more subtle. Trump has really been very explicit about the fact that he's violating everyone's First Amendment rights in this country if they protest the Israel-Gaza war. Well, I actually don't like to call it a war because it's not a war, but it's just Israel bombing Gaza. But yeah, you know what I mean. So anyway, I guess that's sort of my bio in a nutshell.
Yeah, it's been absolutely fascinating to me in a bad way to kind of witness the silence on a lot of people that, you know, everybody said, oh, we have to vote for Trump because he's pro-free speech, because he's anti-war and all this stuff. And then when he gets back in, there has been a lot of good stuff on the domestic policy, at least from like more of a libertarian perspective, like I hail from. But it's so odd to me that you don't see people, you know, calling out the good and the bad. People usually hand wave away either one. Like the people that really don't like Trump, they'll hand wave away all the good stuff and just fixate on the bad stuff. And the people who voted for Trump always seem to hand wave away all the bad stuff when, like, we haven't seen a crackdown on free speech like this, like, it is intense and is like just I've been talking about this ad nauseum, but there's 38 states with anti-BDS laws, and Trump really pushing the lever on that, and just the silence amongst people who claim we had to vote for Trump because of free speech. Just it's mind-boggling to me.
Well, not just the silence. I mean, some are actually openly advocating for this censorship. So, I mean, a lot of the people I worked with during the COVID era on free speech issues are now turning around and trying to justify this censorship. And of course, you know, nobody ever says, I'm pro-censorship. They come up with reasons. You know, it's terrorism language. The person doesn't have a... isn't a citizen. He's a green card holder, so he has no rights, so it's okay to deport him for his speech. Or, you know, in the case of during the COVID era, it was misinformation and disinformation, so it's okay to censor it. So there are always, people always come up with reasons that it, you know, it's hate speech or compromises public safety, or but that is all protected speech. And frankly, all of the speech that I've ever defended is actually core political speech, I would say. It's all speaking on matters of, you know, extraordinary importance, public concern, sort of foreign policy, domestic policy. And that's what the framers of the Constitution intended the First Amendment to protect. That's like, I mean, it's broader than that. But the thing they were most concerned about was that people be able to debate the policies in our country that are, you know, at play.
Yeah. And I got to say, this was almost kind of predictable when you kind of unfortunately followed the money when it came to Trump. You know, when you take over $200 billion from, let's face it, Zionist organizations and Zionist donors, then, you know, eventually they're going to want to see some results for their money. Yeah. And a lot of that was, you know, Trump under his first administration in 2019 signed additional measures to combat anti-Semitism, or it was it might have been worded differently, but that was, I know that's the current one. And it seems like Miriam Adelson's once again getting her picks again in foreign policy and even a little bit on domestic policy. It's just, it's frustrating because you would hope that people would be like, oh, okay, well, even though if I like Israel, I cannot like the fact that they're kind of dicking with our domestic policy.
Yeah.
But a lot of people are just kind of like, oh, no, you kind of just have to accept that Trump is really bad on Israel. But it's like, I don't know how long you can kind of separate these two when now this is coming on to shore. You know what I mean?
Right. Well, and it was never separable, right? Like now it's extremely obvious because it's our actual rights. And we have, you know, people who aren't citizens here now have to be very worried about saying anything against the Trump administration. Right now it's Palestine, but I think it could be broader than that too.
Sure.
And he's also indicated that he's looking into using terrorism laws to go after citizens who participate in protests. So this is not, and I won't be surprised if that's the next step, but you know, it's always mattered to Americans. It's always compromised, I think, American security and well-being. I just actually read an article about how we send $10 million a day to Israel, and we have for a long time.
Yeah.
We sent $400 million to Israel for every soldier of ours, American soldier, who died in Afghanistan. The person who wrote this article is kind of trying to say, we are both giving them the money and the and the soldiers, you know, to fight their wars. Yeah. So... this is, you know, this isn't just a new thing. This isn't just about the speech issues, but I think that's making it very clear to a lot of people, you know, that our First Amendment rights are being compromised in a way they never have before. And it's at the behest of this foreign country. Yeah.
If this was being done on behalf of China or Russia, people would rightfully be losing their minds. Yeah. And just nobody really seems to be up in arms about it. And I do kind of hang around in dissident rights spheres as well. And some of them are more like, oh, we just need to deport these people by any cost, even if they're green card holders, because we need to get these people out of their country. And I'm sympathetic to that argument. And I can't even say that I'm 100% against it, because I do believe there need to be a lot of deportations. But at the same time, it's like, this is clearly like, people who are saying that this is on or just strictly for mass deportations, it's kind of like they're pissing in your ear and telling you it's raining. It's not. It's about punishing people who dissent on Israel. And that's exactly what they did on Mahmoud Khalil.
Right. And I mean, you know, I'm not a huge fan of, I'm definitely not a legal immigration. I certainly think, you know, and that, you know, it'd be very hard to defend somebody who was an illegal immigrant because they can just be deported for no reason at all. But
right.
I mean, he is a green card holder. He's married to a U.S. citizen wife. I think even people who are pretty anti-immigration think that Americans should be able to marry, you know, non-citizens and bring them over. He's expecting a baby, you know, being a green card holder, having lived here for a number of years, he's clearly like working towards creating a life here. He's not, someone who just came here on vacation. I mean, anyway, I would still defend his First Amendment rights. But, and I think, you know, it's important to remember, a lot of people have sort of argued on a from the legal perspective that this isn't about free speech. It's an immigration issue. But the First Amendment is a constraint on government, right? It says Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech. It's not about the speaker. And so it should apply across the board. So the fact, you know, and of course, if there's an immigration law, a statute obviously falls. The Constitution is superior to a statute. So if a statute is in conflict with the Constitution, the statute falls, not the Constitution. And here, if the law is allowing for someone to be deported just based on his speech, which is very clear here, Trump's not even saying anything otherwise, then it's the statute that's the problem, not the Constitution. So I think everybody who's making that argument has it wrong. And hopefully the judge will see it the same way. Mm-hmm.
So what do you think about the people? I've seen people argue that, like, oh, this is weird because he has like 19 judges or 19 lawyers or something that are like Democrats or something like that. Like, people are kind of appealing to conspiracy on this. Do you know much about that? I honestly don't.
Oh, I haven't heard that's an issue. I mean, I can say in like the Missouri versus Biden case we had, which was challenging the Biden administration's censorship of kind of what you would call right-wing speech. I mean, some of our clients weren't actually right-wing, but, you know, it's like conservative speech because they questioned lockdowns and mask mandates and stuff. I mean, there were probably 20 lawyers on that case, a big case. You know, it's a lot of work, especially when it's being done on an emergency basis. So that's pretty normal. I mean, it also is very high profile. So a lot of people are going to want to get on board. Like when we were litigating that case, we had people who definitely were trying to like come work on it with us because it gets your name out there and stuff. So I don't think that's just kind of normal lawyer stuff.
Okay. Yeah. I notice this annoying trend, and I understand why people are conspiratorial, but I call it appealing to conspiracy, where people see something and their eyebrows kind of raise right away when they see it, and then they automatically kind of dismiss all of it as kind of one big conspiracy and think that kind of like justifies their position. It's like, well, do you have like evidence? Like, is there, do you see Democrats paying en masse for these lawyers or something like that? Or is this just like your gut feeling? Because, you know, what's the line? Once again, he's supporting terrorism. He's embedding Hamas or something like that. And Marco Rubio said, oh, yeah, if we knew that he was applying for a green card and he supports Hamas, which like what does that even mean? Then we would never give him a green card. Like there's no objective definition in a lot of this stuff.
No. And also, yes, there are different rules when it comes to, I think Rubio actually mixed it up. They all think he has a visa, even though it's been clarified that he has a green card. Yeah, sure. When you're applying for a student visa, it's different. Like, it would be easier to turn someone away. But once you've given someone the right to be in the country and he has a green card now, I believe he came over on a student visa and then married his wife and got a green card. And it's clearly a real marriage. I mean, I don't exactly know the story, but, you know, that happens all the time. I know many people who've done that. So, I mean, now he's here. It's different. So you can't say, well, we wouldn't have let him in the country if we knew he was going to protest. Well, he's in the country now and he has rights now. You know, obviously, as I'm sure you know, this conflation of pro-Hamas speech, terrorism, it's very clear when they've been pushed. The deputy DHS secretary actually gave an interview where it was clear that he was basically saying pro-Palestine speech, because the guy, no one can pull out any video of him saying anything pro-Hamas or pro-terrorism. All he's saying is, you know, advocating for Palestinian human rights. He has numerous statements saying he thinks Palestinians and Jews should live in peace in the area, and that their fates are intertwined. So, you know, the guy hasn't done anything even remotely wrong.
Yeah, I get pushback from a lot of boomer cons, if you will, about this, saying like, oh, these people are chanting death to America and all this. I'm like, well, actually, like a lot of these protests, they're normally just maybe goofy kids that like, you know, I'm more of a right-wing libertarian, so I probably wouldn't agree with them on a lot of things. But, yeah, like, I think in this situation, they're right. But they're not chanting death to Jews or death to America. And besides that, there's even a lot of Jewish students that are protesting this because, you know, I don't know, like, normal people don't like seeing now the death count of 50,000 people being slaughtered by 2,000-pound bombs over the course of, you know, the last year and a half. I think that's a pretty reasonable thing to protest.
I think it's almost definitely a lot more than 50,000. I think that's a drastic undercount. But that's exactly. And I mean, you know, I'm not very, I don't know. I don't know what my politics are. I'm very libertarian. I don't like woke stuff. So like purple haired college kids aren't really my thing, but they're not, they're not saying these things. It's very clear that by and large, they're advocating for Palestinian human rights. And by the way, the other thing I've noticed is people keep trying to blame Khalil for what other people have done. Well, the protesters, you know, they took over the Hamilton Hall, and they had this illegal encampment. Well, he didn't do that. He's not even accused of doing that. And, you know, sort of classical liberal principles, you can't blame him for what other people did. I mean, there's accomplice liability, which in criminal law, where you can be blamed for what your accomplice does, but there are very specific requirements for that. You have to show, like, you shared the mens rea, you shared the intent to commit the same crime. You certainly can't blame somebody at a protest for the acts of all the other protesters, especially when there are like hundreds or thousands of them. That's completely unrealistic. If you were going to do that, you should just ban protests, because if everybody's guilty of every law that or violation that everyone else does, then you know, it doesn't make any sense. So, that's another thing that's going on, I think.
Yeah, there's this weird thing that people like to do, and I'm sure you've seen it because you have a decent following on Twitter. But people will say, "Oh, well, your audience is all X. You know, if you're a right wing person, your audience is all full of Nazis or something like that." It's like, okay, well, you can't hold me responsible for what people come in and say to my chat, or you know, once again, the situation of Mahmoud Khalil. If he's protesting, he can't help it that maybe some Antifa assholes go do something wrong. Like, like you said, is there mens rea? Did he encourage these people to go do that? Was there coordination? Chances are no. And like you said, there hasn't been any footage of him saying anything or doing anything that would be considered illegal.
Yeah, exactly. And the administration has said many times at this point, they're not accusing him of having committed a crime. So it's, you know, they've made it clear it's just about his views, and they're trying to conflate advocacy for Palestinian human rights with terrorist support, which is not accurate. So it's just flawed on many, many levels.
Yeah. So how familiar are you with how some of these speech laws surrounding Israel work?
It depends on which ones, but I think I'm familiar with a fair amount of them. I mean, it depends on the specific one.
Sure. So I had only recently became aware of this, and I started talking about it a lot because it was so shocking to me that just like nobody talked about this kind of censorship. Probably about 6 months ago, a follower of mine on Twitter, Alex, I think his name is, he sent me the article of when Trump had signed that first anti-Semitism speech law back in 2019. He's like, oh, well, that's weird. So it seemed like it just kind of started with college campuses, right? And then I started looking up, okay, well, how many states are there anti-BDS legislation, which once again, for the audience, anti-boycott, divestment, and sanctioning of Israel. And that's in 38 states, including Pennsylvania, which is where I live. And I don't know what all other states, but there's a lot. Obviously, Texas
most
has.
Most of them.
yeah, exactly. My understanding is that most of them are basically when you're hired as a public employee. So if you work for the government, then you have to sign a pledge that says you won't criticize Israel. And if you do, then you face legal action. Is there more to that that I'm missing or that I don't know? And could you elaborate?
So there are different state statutes because all the states can do their own thing. So I think some of them can even go even further. I heard that there were, I forgot which state, I think it might have been Texas, hurricane victims couldn't get relief unless they would sign a statement saying that they wouldn't boycott Israel.
Yeah. So they I know South Dakota, funds. Christy Noem signed some very aggressive legislation. So I'm sorry to
Oh, yeah, no. All of this is clearly unlawful. I'm actually not sure why people haven't challenged it more. I think one of the reasons, what I've read, is that people have sort of challenged them, and then the state will just say, okay, it's okay, you don't have to do it. So they kind of let you out, and then you don't have a lawsuit anymore, which is sort of a clever way of not having to defend the law, because they know it's unconstitutional, but it chills people. It makes people not want to boycott Israel because they know they might have trouble getting whatever kind of funds they need from the state. And I mean, so a lot of people will, and this argument too, by the way, is made in the context of Trump defunding universities that don't tamp down on pro-Palestine protests, which has caused Columbia to just go crazy, basically. People have said, well, you're not entitled to funding. That's true. But the Supreme Court has been very clear that once the government is offering funding, they can't condition it on the acceptor of the funds, suppressing certain viewpoints or on suppression of certain viewpoints. So that's just sort of classic First Amendment case law. It's not really disputed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when I saw that they were pulling funding from universities, I'm like, okay, well, this is cool because, like, I don't think any of these colleges should be getting any kind of funding. But once again, it's kind of like the camel's nose under the tent, which I think is the thing that a lot of people aren't kind of fixating on. And it said, okay, well, as soon as you condition it on punishing people on the basis of criticism of Israel, then you could just say, oh, well, this is just for college students, which it's not. That first executive order that Trump put out, that's not just limited to college campuses. But, you know, it's, once again, camel's nose under the tent. It starts there, and then it goes to average people. And then if you're on social media and you say, hey, I don't think we should fund Israel anymore, then, you know, under the IHRA's, you know, definition of anti-Semitism, you're now an anti-Semite, and therefore you'd be thrown in jail for up to 10 years, if I remember when I was looking at the actual, like, the actual code that they used.
So I'm unaware right now of criminal penalties for anti-Semitism, but I could have missed something. I didn't actually know about that from 2019. I thought that this was all new.
Well, so the newer one, I'll see if I can find it. Combat anti. Because I remember looking it up, and maybe I didn't do the best jurisprudence or whatever the hell your the right word would be.
Just research.
Yeah, just be careful. And yeah, unfortunately, if you are a public employee, then yeah, they don't like you to bring up Israel at all.
Yeah. That's, you know, I'm with you. I don't understand why these universities are getting public funding. I would be very, very happy if they just cut it all. Of course, you can't do it immediately. You know, you have to give them a little bit of a chance to sort of reshape without the public, without the public funds. But but you can't, you know, you can't say they have to silence pro-Palestine activism or they don't get funds, but pro-Israel activism is fine. That's ridiculous.
Yeah. Okay. So I found the exact statute, and you would probably be able to elucidate upon this further than me. 18 U.S.C. 241, also known as the Conspiracy Against Rights Statute, makes it a federal crime for two or more people to conspire to injure, oppress, threaten, or intimidate someone in the exercise or enjoyment of rights or privileges secured by the Constitution. And under the executive order, it says the Attorney General is encouraged to employ the appropriate civil rights enforcement authorities such as 18 U.S.C. 241 to combat anti-Semitism.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah. So that I did not actually realize that. That they were using that definition of anti-Semitism for the conspiracy to deprive someone of civil rights. That's actually really scary. That makes things scarier.
Okay, could you elaborate on why exactly?
Well, because that, it seems, could allow for much more significant penalties. So if you're convicting someone, I'd have to think this through a little bit, but if you're convicting someone under that statute, conspiracy to violate civil rights, that wouldn't then just... Well, it seems like it's only an application to the executive order applying to college campuses, right? So it's a little unclear to me, but it seems like if they're doing that, they could then just broaden it to other contexts. So they could probably broaden it to the employment context. They could say anybody at any workplace. So if they're using it about students, they could probably come after someone like me. I'm actually not exaggerating. Like, they could say, because there's a sort of similar statute, or it's Title 7 applies to the workplace, Title 9 to, Title 6 to universities. So they could say that, like, I'm making my Jewish colleagues feel unsafe by tweeting pro-Palestine stuff. I don't see how, I feel like that could actually be extended in a very similar way. So that might be what we see next, actually. Clearly what they're trying to do is, like, they're just trying to shut down pro-Palestine speech, and they're using any means at their disposal. So, you know, campuses are easier to control because of the federal funding. Immigrants are easier because they don't, you know, try to just revoke their citizen or their status, their visas or green cards or whatever. So I don't think it's really about immigration or really about college campuses. It's just, like, let's use any means at our disposal to shut down pro-Palestine speech. And my guess is they're going to see how these cases go and then maybe take the next steps going after citizens, just, you know, people like you and I.
Sure. Yeah. And in the executive order, they don't necessarily mention, like, they kind of fixate on Jewish students, right? But nowhere in there do they like necessarily specify, like, this is limited to college campuses. And, like, There's this weird strain of very, very pro-Trump people who are very anti-Israel, which is just, I can never quite square that circle. But they say, oh, well, this is just for like college leftists. They don't want to go after their base. It's like, I'm not entirely sure, because I think when, you know, push comes to shove, Trump's going to have to look at who funded his campaign versus who voted for him. And I think when you give somebody $170 billion, then eventually they say, oh, well, this is a little bit more important, right?
I think you're right. I do think, and like, look, I want to say this carefully. I'm like the least woke person in the world, really. Well, yeah. Not the least. I'm not the least woke person, but I'm not woke. But I do think there's some racism going on here. I think they kind of want to get rid of brown people with funny names. You know, I think you're probably safer if you're white and you have a more European background and name. I just do like, it's just really, for some reason, I just really have a feeling that that's part of what's happening. So I think they definitely want to get rid of anyone they can who's Arab. And so I'm more afraid like they'll come after Arab Americans like me. I mean, they're going to have a hard time with me. You know, my mom's from Minnesota and I was born a U.S. citizen, but I, you know, have my dad's name and look more like him. So
from my buddy Tyler, who's a lawyer as well, he said, I'm drafting a mock CA bill mirroring the IHRA definition, but using LGBT. Right. And see, this was the point that I tried to make. I'm like, okay, yeah. So all you guys who are just kind of silent about this, how would you feel if Joe Biden had said, I'm going to draft legislation to say if you hurt transitioning people's feelings, then you could be thrown into jail, which that code that we were looking at, I believe you could be penalized up to 10 years in jail. How would you feel if Joe Biden was deploying?
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Okay, are we still here? Yeah. When the guest hosts the show, my computer literally just crashed. At the stage.
There you go. Oh, okay.
Sorry about that. My computer literally crashed.
No, I got lost. I've had bad internet occasionally, and so I thought my internet went out, so I like rebooted it. I'm glad it wasn't my internet.
No, it was mine, unfortunately. I literally got it started right up. I can't believe that happened. I'm supposed to be a professional podcaster, and here I am having my computer crash.
No worries at all.
Yeah, all right. One second. Let me get out of this.
All right. Can you hear me? Can you see me? Am I moving okay?
Yes.
Oh. Yeah, professional podcaster right here.
But it happens.
I'm guessing it probably shut off right around where. Yeah. Imagine if Joe Biden was sending whole task forces into major cities to police the anti-trans bigotry of normal people. Right-wingers would rightfully lose their mind, but that's literally happening under the basis of a foreign country right now. Yeah. And it always made me laugh when Trump said, oh, we're occupied. Well, who's occupying us?
Yeah. Yeah, it's, I mean, it's absolutely absurd. And I keep trying to point this out to people who are, you know, pro-Israel on the right. Like, do you not see, I mean, if this was happening in the name of fighting racism or fighting, you know, homophobia or trans, whatever, trans bigotry, I mean, you guys would be losing your minds. It's just, it's really crazy, the hypocrisy on this one issue.
Yeah, so... I have you looked into Mahmoud Khalil's case like closely? I did a podcast on it, and I don't think I really covered too much of the grounds of it. But if you have, what's kind of like the status, and let's kind of lay out that whole situation here.
Sure, I have, with the caveat that I haven't read the judge's latest order. So I know the sum and substance, but I haven't actually read it. So what's happening right now is the judge has ordered that he not be kept in Louisiana, and that he not, it's not a trial, but that the judicial proceedings will occur in New Jersey. So that's good news, because they had transferred him to Louisiana, I suspect because they were hoping to get a more favorable judge who would just hear like national security threat and rubber stamp the deportation. And I also think that they probably were trying to break him down emotionally by separating him from his lawyers and his wife. So the judge in New York said no, it's transferred to New Jersey. His lawyers have filed a motion for a preliminary injunction, which is emergency relief, basically arguing that his rights are being violated right now, and this needs to end, so that we don't have to go through the whole litigation process before he's let out of detention.
Mm-hmm. So why did they ship him down to Louisiana? Because he was originally in, what was it, New York?
So he, I believe he lived in New York. They briefly were going to bring him to the facility in New Jersey. As far as I know, I lived in New York City for 13 years, and I represented indigent defendants on their appeals. And I often worked with immigration lawyers. The clients were being deported, and so I would work with immigration lawyers on the criminal side. They'd work on the immigration side. So I know a little bit about the system. New York, I don't think, has an ICE detention center, only New Jersey. Mm. So they claim that it was because there were too many bed bugs at the New Jersey facility, which I really doubt, because why are other people there then?
Yeah.
So they took him to Louisiana like sometime in the morning, and his attorneys filed what's called a habeas petition at like 4:40 in the morning, which was very good, because the fact that they had filed it before he left meant that the New York court retained jurisdiction over the case. Otherwise, there would have been the government would have had a really good argument that the whole thing should have just taken place in Louisiana. And then he would have just started with the Louisiana judge, which could go way worse for him, I think, based on what I know about the judges there. So the New York judge in Manhattan basically said, no, this is going over to New Jersey. So right now the proceedings are in the district court in New Jersey.
Okay, so the case is still kind of ongoing, and... Man, it's sad. And one other thing that's always kind of weird to me about this is that like people don't look at like the precedent being set. And you know, for people who say, oh yeah, he should be deported because he's a brown person and we don't like him, we don't want him in this country, it's like, okay, well, now you could say that he's leaving an anchor baby behind, but now you're also leaving a single mother here in the country.
Yeah.
You know, those people of that persuasion, which I consider myself somewhat of that persuasion. Now you have somebody who's going to grow up without a father. And, you know, I don't think I have to make that argument that kids without fathers typically don't do as well as kids with fathers.
Right. And I mean, another thing about Mahmoud Khalil is that he grew up in an immigration camp in Syria because his family were driven out of Palestine by the Israelis. You know, Israel creating all of these refugees is ultimately having people come here. My dad came here. My dad's Palestinian. He came here in his 20s because he couldn't stand living under the Israeli occupation. He was, you know, daily humiliation. He had no freedom. He couldn't do it. He wanted to stay. He loved his family. They have very close-knit communities. It broke his heart to leave, but he was just... he felt he could have no life there, no like security or freedom. So that's why he's here. So, you know, our support for Israel is creating all of these people who would be happy to stay in their homeland, who would prefer to stay in their homeland, even though we have a better economy. They're very attached to it the way most people are attached to their homes. They don't want to leave. But, you know, if we're making, if Gaza is uninhabitable, which Israel is making very sure it is, I mean, it already is, but now it's even worse. And the West Bank is horrible. With the occupation and the settler violence, where are all these people going to go? The Arab countries don't want them too, which, you know, I think they should take them in. I think they're what they're doing is really bad, but they don't want millions of refugees.
Yeah, I mean, it's, and I'm sure you agree with this, and most people would, is that like it's kind of unfair to push that upon a country to tell them you have to accept 2 million people, because you know Israel wants to commit ethnic cleansing. You know, even if it was 200 of the most brilliant, you know, white Americans, that still changes the structure of a society. It changes the way that it functions. It changes the general demographic, which, you know, people kind of like the idea of like, oh, no, I go to Poland, I see Polish people. I go to Israel, I see Israelis, Palestinians. People like kind of like their own culture. So when you put a whole another group of people there that aren't from there, it, once again, now you're also straining infrastructure, and that's, you know, I think it's wrong for other countries to have to strain their infrastructure because Israel wants to have a couple more golf courses or something like that, you know?
Absolutely. I mean, I'm completely sympathetic to that point of view. I don't know what's supposed to, I mean, Israel doesn't, you know, they want the land without the people. It's not just golf courses. Yeah. They just very much don't want the Palestinians there because they want the land. And they use security as an excuse. They've done it for decades. Of course, if you make people miserable enough, you're going to create a security risk. That's, you know, at some point the slaves are going to rebel. So not that I'm, and I'm obviously have to like do the song and dance about Hamas. I don't support Hamas. I don't support what they did. I never support violence against civilians, but you know, that's sort of the inevitable outcome if you keep people in conditions like Gaza was before, well before October 7th, and the West Bank has been for a long time. So I like, what's supposed to happen to these people? And Israel right now is pummeling Gaza. I think they're making it clear that they're going to just kill everybody in there, 2 million people. So.
Yeah. The ancillary effects of their bombing campaign and everything over the last 18 months or somewhere around there, it's brutal. Yeah. And everyone keeps saying, oh, well, you trust the Hamas numbers. It's like, yeah, but like every single time they always did these death count numbers, they're always usually proven to be like an undercount because Israel is very, very sloppy and they don't care how many people they kill. And, you know, we're supposed to believe that's the most moral army in the world. Although I don't think moral armies kill, what is it, like over 20,000 children?
At least. No. And they, I mean, there's clear evidence that the IDF soldiers have shot children intentionally in the head. There were 65 healthcare workers in from not Gaza and mostly Western healthcare workers who were going to testify. They did testify to Congress, actually, about this, noticing a pattern of children shot in the head and chest, which they said could only be, you know, it could only be intentional that you would see this. And no one in Congress bothered to show up. Like, could you imagine if these were Israeli children? Every single member of Congress would have been there waving Israeli flags. I mean, the blatant disregard for the lives of certain people is, it's heartbreaking.
Yeah. You would have Brian Mast showing up every single day in his IDF uniform.
And John Fetterman.
Yeah, my God. Yeah, that's been one of the most frustrating things for me as a person in Pennsylvania. I see all these retarded MAGA people, and it's like, I'm very sympathetic to you. Like, I'm an automotive mechanic by trade. So, like, these are my people, but they're like, oh, John Fetterman's the only Democrat that makes sense. I'm like, he said the moderate position on the border and only dresses up when Bibi Netanyahu comes through town.
Yeah.
And like all of a sudden he's the super ultra based Democrat because he supports Israel. I'm like, you guys are fucking nuts.
Yeah. I mean, unfortunately, you know, most Americans have been fed decades of propaganda. And you know, what you're seeing now is very blatant and in your face. And I do like to think that part of the extreme nature of the censorship is because they're desperate, because they realize that people's minds are being changed and the tide is turning. So this is a resort, and I don't think it's going to work. I mean, most people just have these ideas in their heads that can be very, very difficult to change, that Palestinians, Arabs just hate them. They hate us for our freedom, that we're basically like Israel and Hamas is going to come over here and kill us if we don't stop it. I mean, just things that are not true. And like, I'm not, you know, I'm not a Muslim at all. I was not raised a Muslim, and I'm not particularly a fan of the religion, although it's like Christianity. It has like many variations to say. I'm not like, I don't know. Some strains seem to be very nice. I think all of it always depends on the person who's practicing it rather than the religion itself. But, you know, I'm not like generally speaking a fan of Islam, but you know, I have all my relatives on my dad's side are in Palestine. They don't just hate Americans. They don't just hate Jews. They are very resentful because they see the West as rightly having contributed to their oppression significantly, and like that they're not free because, and they get killed all the time and imprisoned and have their land taken because of us. So, you know, if we just stopped doing this, we would actually be safer.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that is absolutely true. And I'm glad you kind of brought it back to that point, because it really is our foreign policy that makes Americans less safe, and that really provides instability all throughout the world. And, yeah. You know, the foreign aid that goes to Israel really is just like a giant moral hazard. Basically, you're telling them, well, you can do whatever you want and we'll continually send you money, right? Yeah. You kill all these people and generate sincere hatred for our country, yeah. And I'm sure on the part of some bad actors, our people, but, you know, we'll still just continue providing you aid rather than saying like, okay, well, if we're going to provide you aid, it has to be mutually beneficial or finding some better agreement, which once again, I'm of the persuasion, and I'm sure you are too, that just like we shouldn't be funding any countries. Like this is absolutely ridiculous.
Yeah. No, I mean, I agree with you completely on that. So.
Yeah, it's so frustrating. And I had I was talking to my bass player yesterday, and when I was trashed on Friday night, I have that little squid, right? Because there was that meme going around like a year or two ago with Greta Thunberg with the little squid, and they said it was an anti-Semitic squid.
Oh, and, yeah.
Someone wanted us to take a picture, and I think I said something about Jews, just like as a joke because I was drunk. And then like when my wife explained to me, I'm like, oh, that's because that's an anti-Semitic squid. And they said it's an anti-Semitic symbol. And we were talking last night. He's like, oh, you should really hate Muslims. Like those people really don't like us. I'm like, well, like who has more influence on the country, Muslims or Jews? And like, I'm not saying you should hate either group. I'm just saying that like AIPAC, it's undeniable that they rig our elections, and they talk about it openly and brazenly.
I know.
So like Muslims aren't coming over here and restricting our freedoms. But as we've laid out this entire show, the Israeli lobby is, and it's undeniable. I mean, there's objective proof of that happening.
Yeah, I mean, they don't hide it. They say, I mean, they keep saying they're trying to unseat Thomas Massie, who's by far the best member of Congress, in my opinion, because he's not adequately pro-Israel. And like, you know, I mean, they brag about it. They say, if you're not pro-Israel enough, you know, pro-Israel is good politics, and we're going to make sure that people who are not pro-Israel don't get elected. So, and they successfully ousted Jamal Bowman and Cory Bush, I think. I mean, I'm not fans of either of those people on any other topic, but, you know, it's very clear that they have a very, very high success rate.
Yeah, I just, there's still like this lingering war on terror attitude, and it still remains in the Trump administration where it kind of seems like, you know, it's like George Bush all over again, where basically like, oh, they keep bringing up terrorism. And like, you've even seen Tulsi Gabbard do stuff like this, where she's saying like, oh, you know, we got to stamp out radical Islamic terrorism. Like, I'm 100% sure there's maybe some Muslims out there that are saying death to America or something like that. Do they actually pose any threat? Like, are we really going to kid ourselves and think that like Muslims are going to come over here en masse and start slaughtering people? Like, if we really wanted to, we could wipe those countries off the face of the map. I'm not advocating we do that, but I'm just saying, like, we have the biggest, baddest military in the world, and we're scared of Iran. Like, seriously. Yeah.
And I mean, to you know, again, like, I don't defend terrorism, I'm not, but when you look at the reasons, I mean, even Osama bin Laden, when you read what he was saying, he was talking about how America has supported and is responsible for the deaths of so many Arabs, which is true, by our unequivocal support for Israel, that he saw during the invasion of Lebanon how many innocent Lebanese people were killed, and it was because of America supporting Israel. And they don't want you to know that. That's why there was this massive censorship campaign to have his letter censored, basically, because it was going around on TikTok, and all these politicians tried to make sure you couldn't read it. And like, again, I'm not justifying it. And then people always try to twist one's ideas with this. The point is, we have to understand where this is coming from. And Muslims did not just hate the West in 1950. Well, maybe starting around then, because that's when Israel was created, 1948. But in 1900, there was no But there was this pattern of Western intervention in the Middle East, and then the blind support of Israel, which just has increased over the decades. And that's really made people turn against us. And they see how little we care about their lives and their, you know, and how willingly we bomb them and kill their children. So they, you know, they don't have a great impression of, certainly not of our government. I don't, you know, it's hard to talk in sweeping terms about what they think of individual American citizens. I correspond with some people on Twitter and stuff in the Middle East, and they generally seem to think that people are very ignorant, and it's shocking to them how little most Americans care about what their tax money is doing.
Yeah, I've found that I've usually been surprised when I talk to people from other countries, and I think a lot of Americans are like this, where we're all pretty insulated and we don't realize, like, oh, China and Russia are actually just like normal countries just like America. Like, obviously they have a different culture and stuff like that, but like the people over there are a lot like us in a lot of respects. And even like in a lot of Muslim countries, they have, you know, completely different culture, but same deal. They want to go to work and they want to be able to enjoy the fruits of their labor and support their family. It's not like they're, once again, scheming to come over here and blow up America. They just want to be left alone and have their own country for their own people.
Exactly. I mean, I couldn't, that's exactly my view. And, you know, I think that's sort of what the heart of racism is, right? Is when you think that there are some people who just, groups of people who just have totally different priorities. You know, their priority isn't to provide with their family, to provide for their family and spend time with their family and, you know, whatever, have a job that gives them some level of satisfaction and have some freedom and ability to choose their own life course. That there are these people whose number one goal is to kill Jews or kill Americans, that's completely ridiculous. If that might become their number one goal after their children have been killed by American bombs. Yeah. And Americans should understand that. Like, we should be the first people to understand that. Like, you know, just imagine if your children were killed by, you know, missiles from that country, that you're going to hate them. That's just how it goes.
Yeah, so in your line of work, are you optimistic with how things are going, or kind of where are you at?
I'm somewhat optimistic that eventually the courts will vindicate the First Amendment rights of people like Khalil. And also, you know, there are other cases like the universities being deprived of funding and that kind of thing for not suppressing pro-Palestine speech. I think the First Amendment arguments are pretty strong. I'm never totally sure. And the Supreme Court now is it's a national security court in many ways, I'd say. A number of the members are they kind of hear safety, national security. And that's why we actually, in a sense, lost the case against the Biden administration. It's very complicated procedurally. I don't want to bore anybody too much, but it was on an emergency motion on appeal in the Supreme Court. And so they said we didn't have standing. Our clients couldn't show that they had been censored by the government because the social media companies had their own content moderation policies. We couldn't show that our client's specific censorship had resulted because of the government's influence. So they suggested that there could be people who would be able to make a stronger showing. But they seemed, you know, I would say when they asked questions at argument, they seemed very concerned about like the safety issues and stuff like that. So I'm not confident about the Supreme Court, but I do think the legal arguments are strong. If the plaintiffs in these cases lose, I would say the landscape for First Amendment law and free speech is really bad. But I would say even if they win, it's kind of bad. because I just don't think we have a culture that supports free speech. And in the end, like, all of this has to come from the people. You know, the courts are just people in the end. And they're sort of responsive to the public opinion, and they read the newspaper, and their views are shaped the same way that our views are shaped. And until there's a real demand from the populace to preserve our First Amendment rights, I think it's unlikely that we're going to see a lot of it reflected in the courts. And so even if these specific plaintiffs win, I think they'll just come up with new ways to censor. And what happens a lot is, you know, it takes a long time for a lawsuit to go through. So a lot of people can still be harmed and a lot of people will still be silent. I mean, it's probably going to take at least a year until these cases are resolved, maybe more. And in the meantime, a lot of people are not going to go to pro-Palestine protests. You know, a lot of people are going to stay silent, especially non-citizens. So the government can kind of win the the war, even if they lose the battle. You know, like, ultimately they might be able to keep people silent about Palestine while the worst stuff is going on in Gaza as it is right now.
Man, that sounds grim.
Sorry. I'm a
that's okay.
I'm a glass half empty kind of person.
I'm typically a glass half full, but I try to be a realist as well. So I know you've also had some tangs with the Biden administration. You said that those didn't go so well.
So that case is the main one. I've had other ones too. We also have sued on for some of the Biden administration's vaccine mandates. None of our cases actually reached the Supreme Court, because what happens when these things happen, like, a lot of people file lawsuits and then one will get there, but it's not necessarily yours. So we challenged the federal employee vaccine mandate and the federal contractor vaccine mandate, and those were ultimately successful. It just wasn't us who got to the Supreme Court. Missouri versus Biden case, the censorship one did not succeed on the emergency motion, but we're actually still ongoing in the lower court. So you file the lawsuit and you can file for emergency relief at the same time, basically saying, like, we can't wait the 2 or 3 years it's going to take to go through all of this. We need relief right now because our rights are being violated. And the burden of proof is kind of high, but you don't go through all the discovery and stuff. So you show that you're likely to succeed on the merits. You don't actually succeed on the merits. And so it's a different standard. And so the court basically said, well, just because you lost on the preliminary injunction doesn't mean you can't win on the lawsuit. So we're still in the lower court going forward on the lawsuit, but, it's slow.
Oh my God. Yeah. That does sound terrible. I don't know how you do it and other people do it. As a tech, I kind of like being able to move cars in and out as fast as possible, but sitting in a courtroom all fancy, dressed up and everything for days and days at a time, I'd be like, man, please get me the fuck out of here.
I'm mostly in an office. You just go to court on rare occasions in my in my line of work. So mostly just writing and conferencing in offices.
Oh my God. Yeah. So with those, it's so interesting because it does seem like with the being censored by social media, you know, obviously there were clear signs that Twitter, Facebook, and wherever else was working with the government. But I'm guessing the challenge that you face is just kind of like getting the objective proof of, like, this person was censored and this was X done by X government employee. Exactly. Like, it just seems like a lot of ambiguity.
Exactly. That was exactly the issue. And they wanted a lot of specificity. So they wanted to show that a specific agency or government actor had sort of made an order and the company had acted on that order. They were dissatisfied. I mean, the evidence we had was, it was a little bit more nebulous. I thought it was strong enough, but, you know, the government had threatened, pressured, coerced the companies and also worked with them extensively. And they would say, you know, censor on certain topics, for instance. One of the more shocking ones was, you know, censor anyone who gives accounts of the side effects of the vaccine. We don't care if it's true, but it might cause people to not want to get the vaccine. So we thought that the fact that people were censored on that topic after the Biden administration gave those orders would be enough. But the court basically said, well, the companies had content moderation policies before. They might have escalated enforcement, but you don't know that your client's censorship was the result of that escalation. Mm-hmm. That could have occurred anyway. So you don't have what's called standing. And incidentally, you know, I just wrote a piece about this that was published in Compact, but a lot of liberals were very happy about that because they thought the government should be able to do this in the name of public safety, you know, certainly when our guy's in office, because they forget that the other guy will be in office and he can use the same. And I told them, you know, this can be used against you. And I've actually seen now that the same doctrine is being used. So if the universities punish a student because they're under pressure from the administration, the courts are now going to say you have to prove that the student was only censored because the Trump administration had this policy. It's not enough, you know, maybe the university would have done it on its own. How do we know? So that specific doctrine is going to be used against liberals, or, you know, typical liberal speech. So this is why, you know, I urge people to really understand that when you advocate for the government to have more power and to be able to violate people's civil liberties, that can just be flipped and used against you when the party you don't like is in office.
Yeah, I think that's kind of like the base libertarian argument, is that, like, would you want the worst person in power having this power over your life? Yeah. And as we could see, I don't think Donald Trump's the worst person in the world. And I mean, I was pretty pro-Trump back like 2017, 2018. I didn't vote for him ever. And I probably still wouldn't have gone back and voted for him if you gave me the chance. Maybe back in 2016, had I known what I know now. But, you know, it's just that. And then obviously I would never vote for a Democrat either, because just, yeah. I mean, it's completely obvious why you would. But, you know, I just wish there was a consistent group of people who were always like, no, we need free speech no matter what, because this is also how you think and how you formulate ideas, by communicating these ideas and these things to other people. And when you lose that, then you're really going down a bad path.
Yeah, it's very hard to get people to see that. And so most of my relatives on my mom's side, like, you know, uncles, aunts, are very liberal, sort of typical boomer liberals, and I was trying to explain to them, you know, how that the policies that they championed during Biden's administration would now be used against them, and they just can't get it through their head. They say, well, but Biden was trying to protect the public safety. I'm like, but don't you get that's the same justification that Trump is using? That's the same thing. He's saying anti-Semitism is basically a national security threat. So once you allow this, but people have a lot of trouble wrapping their heads around it. They think, like, I'm right. And so ultimately, I don't quite know how it translates. I don't think most people understand the principles of civil liberties. And it is counterintuitive. I mean, most people, when they hear a speech that offends them or that they don't like, their impulse is to want to shut the speaker up. It's not a pleasant experience to hear someone say things that you really disagree with. But that's an impulse we all have to fight, I think, if we want to live in a free society.
Yeah, I agree completely. And, you know, as somebody who's changed their mind on quite a lot of things, I know if I had the ability to silence everybody that disagreed with me, I would be a lot worse off for it.
Yeah,
I think that's an important thing to kind of remember, is that sometimes the people that you disagree with the most may have something that you need to hear.
Yeah. And I mean, there are lots of reasons that the framers included the First Amendment and the Bill of Rights. I mean, their justifications for free speech are very interesting to read, because they sort of understood a lot of the concepts I think people have trouble understanding today, which is also, you know, censorship doesn't make ideas go away. Bad ideas go away. If people say, no offense to anyone who thinks the vaccine has a microchip, I think it probably doesn't. But like, if people say the vaccine has a microchip and you censor them, what happens is they just form like groups where they talk to each other. They don't stop believing. And the more you censor them, they actually think there's more conspiracy going on. So, you know, or actual anti-Semitic speech, not criticism of Israel, but when you start to censor that, people just go underground and they start to talk about it in chat groups, and it actually brings out conspiracy ideas and stuff like that. So the idea is that the best cure for so-called bad speech is debate, allowing people to respond. You know, if you put something on Twitter that's not true or that's hateful, people have the opportunity to respond and to explain why you're wrong and you shouldn't, you know, that's not the correct view. If you censor it, they just start to talk to other people offline who have the same views or in private chat groups or whatever. So it's just not an effective way of dealing with things.
Yeah, I completely agree. And especially on like the vaccine stuff, I always share, back in 2020, I want to say it was March 6th of 2020, so before lockdowns really started becoming a big thing, I remember I put, I'm not scared of the coronavirus, because I'm like, this smells like bullshit. And it was just going out on a limb, but I just had that feeling. And yeah, man, was I vindicated after that?
Yeah.
But, you know, the whole vaccine thing, it's funny because like, I'm anti-mandate, obviously. I think every reasonable person is anti-vaccine mandate. But it's like, yeah, I mean, in my reading of most of the literature, it doesn't seem like it's like population control, like some people say. But when you censor people for saying that, then like you said, now you're confirming in their heads, oh, if I'm being censored for speaking or for saying this, then I must be speaking the truth. So then, like you said, people get in chat groups, and then, you know, it's appealing to conspiracy. Hey, I must be right because I was censored for this. They're punishing people who are speaking the truth, when it's like, okay, you may have said something that was just objectively wrong, but you shouldn't be censored for that. You should have someone, you know, talk to somebody who might know more than you about it. And then you may find out, oh, no. Maybe there definitely are side effects from the vaccine, but it's not like dropping people en masse like some people are saying. But once again, the reason why that became so prominent is because so many people had been censored for just asking questions about it.
Yeah. And I think the natural question to ask when you're censored is, wait a second, am I saying something that's that dangerous to the people in power? Because if this is just crazy, why are they so threatened by it? So.
Yeah, it's definitely concerning. Well, Janine, I know you had a little bit of a time limit, so I want to let you plug everything you want to plug. And everybody, make sure you go check out her podcast, Previously Unprohibited, right?
previously prohibited.
Oh, previously prohibited. I'm sorry. I knew it was something close to that, but I woke up super early, and you had a bunch of my mutual friends on. You had Dave DeCamp on and Brad Pierce, and I really, really enjoyed those shows. And obviously, you and your co-host talking together, I thought the show was very enjoyable. So everybody make sure you go check that out. So yeah, go ahead.
We'll have to have you on sometime. So that's my podcast. And my Twitter is just at JenineYounesesq. Kind of long, but Jenine Younes Esquire. That's basically where I am. So thank you so much for having me.
No, of course. Tyler, good show. Been following Jenine on Twitter. Good follow. I agree completely. And anytime you guys want to do it, just let me know. And like I said, I'm a big fan of you guys' show. And if you don't got anything else, I think we'll end there.
Great. Thanks so much. Have a good one.
Of course, you too.